Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the looming possibility of a nuclear war with North Korea as the Kim Jong-un regime accelerates its nuclear and missile programs, extending its current capability of threatening South Korea and Japan to being able to strike the continental U.S. with nuclear-armed missiles. Dr. Van Jackson, a professor at the Asia-Pacific Center for Security Studies, who was a strategist and policy advisor focused on the Asia-Pacific at the Office of the Secretary of Defense, joins us to discuss his article at Foreign Affairs, Preventing Nuclear War with North Korea, and what can be done to deter North Korea from using nuclear weapons by conveying limited aggressive intentions while shoring up deterrence against low-level attacks by North Korea, as well as rethinking the role of U.S. forces in Korea, which is stuck in a 1980s mindset. Then we'll examine the new report from Public Citizen, The Company They Keep, a guide to the presidential candidate's domestic policy advisors, and speak with the report's author, Taylor Lincoln, a research director of the Congress Watch Division of Public Citizen. He joins us to contrast and compare the rival teams of domestic policy advisors with the Trump team heavy on Wall Street hedge funders and LBO asset strippers like Carl Icahn and Henry Kravis, along with the Wall Street cheer squad of Lawrence Kudlow and Stephen Moore, while Hillary Clinton's team is dominated by mainstream economists. Then finally, we will speak with Walt Glaser, a retired historian who taught at the University of Pittsburgh, who has a letter in Wednesday's New York Times, Trump, Master of Marketing. We'll discuss the tightening of the polls that has Trump closing on Clinton, which makes the role of the Libertarian and Green Party presidential candidates more critical as potential spoilers who could swing the election for Trump. And since our politics have been transformed by money, celebrity, and advertising that has captured the media and the minds of Americans, will Trump's style and success as a huckster win out over Hillary Clinton's teacher-knows-best persona? And joining us now is Dr. Van Jackson, Associate Professor at the Asia-Pacific Center for Security Studies. From 2009 to 2014, he held positions in the Office of the Secretary of Defense as a strategist and policy advisor focused on the Asia-Pacific and as a senior country director for Korea and working group chair of the U.S. Republic of Korea Extended Deterrence Policy Committee. His latest book is Rival Reputations, Coercion and Credibility in U.S.-North Korean Relations, and he has an article at Foreign Affairs, Preventing Nuclear War with North Korea. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Van Jackson.
Hi, Ian. Thanks for having me on.
And are we sort of inexorably heading towards some kind of confrontation, perhaps nuclear, given the accelerated pace of North Korea's nuclear and missile program under Kim Jong-un? And there's an upcoming test, apparently. There was a recent test. And I recall back in 1994, during the Clinton administration, there was an almost nuclear war, or an almost war with Korea, I should say, that prompted Jimmy Carter to go over to North Korea with CNN, allegedly to defuse the situation. So we've seen things get out of hand before, but I take it that the real concern is that North Korea is moving rapidly towards its ability to have a nuclear-tipped missile strike the continental United States.
That's right. I mean, unfortunately, conflict is at our doorstep whether we like it or not. And the more dire question right now, other than recognizing that, is whether or not it goes nuclear, which to most people is insane and impossible. But to North Korea, it's entirely plausible given the circumstances. And so the question is, how do we maintain our commitments in the region? How do we maintain stability while not triggering a larger conflagration while minimizing damage, while preventing a nuclear war? That's where we're at right now.
But on the North Korean side, the paranoia is both genuine and it's also state-induced, is it not?
It's both, and that makes it particularly tough to unravel. So in theory, the fact that we have intermittent or continuous engagements and negotiation with them, et cetera, that over the years we've sporadically attempted a rapprochement here and there, that should have made some difference, but xenophobia and enmity toward external threats like the U.S. and like South Korea makes sort of unraveling it through our policies very difficult.
So I take it that the recent flyby of B-1 bombers, nuclear-capable B-1 bombers, close to the 38th parallel was not, to your mind, a good idea.
It was not. So one important nuance here is that technically the B-1 is not nuclear-capable, but the other, like P-52, is nuclear-capable. But from North Korea's perspective, they are all delivering nuclear payloads. And North Korean statements about some of our deployments, even when it's conventional bombers, like non-nuclear bombers, they still are under the impression that these things carry nukes. And so this is a fundamental problem with the basic orientation of our policy toward North Korea. So, in the 1970s, 1980s, we had the same basic approach to North Korea that we do today. But back then, they were a sort of fourth-tier state that did not have nuclear weapons, and it was in the midst of the Cold War, right? So much has changed. The biggest thing that has changed is now they're a second-tier, what we call nuclear-armed adversary, and the requirements of deterrence and assurance against a second-tier nuclear-armed adversary are not the same as the North Korea of the 1970s and 1980s. And that gap, the difference between what it takes to deter North Korea today as compared to yesterday, that gap is where we could end up sleepwalking into a nuclear conflict against our own preferences.
But is there a difference between, in terms of deterrence, in other words, riding out an attack, which does seem insane, but a lot of North Korea's assets are underground. Seoul is very close to the border. North Koreans have often talked about, just through conventional means, turning South Korean capital Seoul into a sea of fire. Mm-hmm. It would seem to me that, well, let me ask you directly, are the North Koreans, in their mind, capable of riding out an attack and are therefore less vulnerable? After all, the entire country was pretty much wiped off the map, was it not, in the Korean War?
Yeah, so this is part of the motivation for this accelerated rush to the nuclear finish line that they're under right now. So under Kim Jong-un, the last 4 years, they've done 49 missile tests plus the 3 nuclear tests. And this is vast. This is much, much faster than under Kim, the North Korea under his father. The reason why is because if they can get a sufficient number of nukes and it's sufficiently diverse locations and diverse delivery vehicles, then they can guarantee if we launch preventive strikes, if we invade, that they can guarantee that they can cause a nuclear conflict. And there's a chance that that will deter us. And, that might just work. And so that's why they're crashing so fast on developing all this. And in the meantime, it seems like we're just letting it happen. And that's the danger, because once they get to that point of assured retaliation, that really boxes us in. Whoever is going to be president is going to have to deal with a North Korea that can threaten credibly nuclear war. And they're not quite there yet, but they will be at some point in, probably the next few years.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Van Jackson, Associate Professor at the Asia-Pacific Center for Security Studies. From 2009 to 2014, he held positions in the Office of the Secretary of Defense as a strategist and policy advisor focused on the Asia-Pacific and as a senior country director for Korea and working group chair of the U.S. Republic of Korea Extended Deterrence Policy Committee. His latest book is Rival Reputations, Coercion and Credibility in U.S.-North Korean Relations, and he has an article at Foreign Affairs, Preventing Nuclear War with North Korea. So at this point, does North Korea basically have the ability to threaten South Korea and Japan?
Yes, as well as U.S. bases in both countries.
And what would your guess be of how long before they'll be able to threaten the continental U.S.?
It is a little bit of a guessing game. I would say no more than 10 years, probably within the next 5 years.
So if we, back in 1994, the Clinton administration was prepared to preemptively strike North Korea, I believe because of the nascent nuclear program, which is nothing like it, it was hardly off the ground. Now we have a whole different ball game, right? But they've diversified their sites. They've, you know, whatever they've, I don't know how many nuclear weapons they have. Frankly, it would seem to me one of their earlier tests, which was in the low kiloton range, there were some reports that it might have been a fission trigger. Are they anywhere near thermonuclear, do you think?
So most experts would say not quite. But again, the black box nature of it all makes it a little bit hard to say with confidence. So probably not yet. And they're you know, the most reasonable estimates about their current nuclear stockpile is, you know, 10 to 20 nuclear weapons, which frankly is plenty to do cause serious problems in the region for the U.S.
But is it reasonable to assume that the fact that Kim Jong-un has been able to accelerate the program such in this devastatedly poor country that just had a massive flood on its northern area with China, that they must be getting some real technical help, I assume, from former Soviet nuclear scientists?
Yeah, so it's a largely indigenous nuclear program, but it got started on the shoulders of Soviet technology, Chinese support, and then most importantly, the AQCON network from Pakistan. And they stood on the shoulders of giants to some extent to build their indigenous capability. But in an active sense, not 100%, I don't think any of those countries are actively helping them. China in particular wishes this would all just go away, I think. But North Korea is, within its own resources, just hurtling toward an assured retaliation capability.
But the AQCON network, I think they got their starts from blueprints of a Chinese nuclear weapon, did they not?
I think that's right, yeah.
Yeah. So that's a bit strange, isn't it? Not that China cooperated necessarily with the transfer to North Korea, but you say that China was involved in some way in the program. Now they are in a position where everybody's asking China to do something about the latest test. All the sanctions in the world have been already applied, and it doesn't seem to deter the North Koreans in any way. And at this point, North Korea is actually asking for food aid because of the flooding. I take it that the Chinese position simply is that, one, they don't want U.S. forces on the Yalu River again, as they did in the Korean War, and two, they don't want North Korea to collapse and have to deal with all of the refugees.
That's right. And there's a third point, which is that China is all too happy to have North Korea's missiles aimed at U.S. bases in South Korea and Japan. So China has a strong interest in not doing anything that would force North Korea to change the trajectory to aim missiles at Beijing. And that point is probably the most important, but often the most lost. The other points are true, too. They want a strategic buffer. They see North Korea as that strategic buffer, and they don't want large-scale refugee flows.
But the point that you just made, though, you can see what the advantage is. Deterrence between two big nuclear powers like China and the United States, or China and Russia, is one thing, but a wild card third player with whom you have a certain amount of deniability is, I suppose, in a sort of sinister way, an advantage.
Yeah, depending on how you look at it. And if it was an advantage, which it seems in some ways it is, that would help explain why China sort of stymies most of our efforts at the UN Security Council to increase pressure on North Korea, why they are inconsistent or slow in enforcing sanctions against North Korea themselves, why they maintain a degree of foreign and direct investment in North Korea, why, basically China keeps North Korea propped up. They're the one country that has the greatest leverage over North Korea, but they're the one country with an interest in not disrupting North Korea too much either.
So I've spoken to a number of specialists on North Korea, and of course there's quite a divide in terms of what to do. Sumi Terry, who used to be with the National Security Council under President George W. Bush, is certainly much more hawkish than Donald Gregg, former U.S. ambassador to South Korea, who wants to engage with the North Koreans and told me that he said, I'd rather talk than fight. But that's easier said than done, surely. So let's talk about your article in Foreign Affairs, Dr. Van Jackson, Preventing Nuclear War with North Korea. Just briefly walk us through your suggestions that seem to be contradictory in as much as you want to demonstrate resolve and conveying only limited aggressive intentions, but at the same time you want to shore up deterrence against low-level violence short of war and give a new mandate to U.S. forces in Korea.
That's right. So this is a very difficult needle to thread, but the consequences of failure are so great that we have to try, I think. So on the one hand, because North Korea is a de facto nuclear state, and because North Korea has a nuclear doctrine right now of asymmetric escalation, which is effectively first use, right? Escalate to de-escalate, drop a nuke to scare us and make us back down. That's their sort of current posture. If that's the case, then the idea of forced unification, invasion, regime change, total war, sort of the traditional approach on the military side, all that stuff is just Casuspelli, right, for a nuclear Casuspelli. That is the stuff that will trigger a nuclear war. It creates incentives for North Korea to go first on nukes, and we don't want that. But at the same time, we do have a deterrence problem. We do have a South Korea that shows interest in going nuclear, and we have intermittent violence continuing on the peninsula. So we have to both establish deterrence at thresholds below total war to deal with the real problem of small-scale violence that South Korea continually faces, that we continually face. And at the same time, we have to sort of de-emphasize the role of nuclear weapons on the peninsula overall, because North Korea's willingness to get violence, which it's shown it has a propensity for this, it will happen again at some point, probably before the end of the year. When that happens, there's a good chance of retaliation. And if the backdrop for that retaliation is a North Korean expectation that we're going to fly in the B-52s to drop bombs and we're going to invade and decapitate the regime, if that's their expectation, then the mushroom cloud comes. That's when nukes go. And so we have to simultaneously establish a willingness to fight back, to show that there is a cost to small-scale violence, but also that our intentions are limited, right? We are not trying to decapitate the regime when we fight back. We're not trying to flow large-scale reinforcements. We're not trying to start a nuclear war. And so nukes have been interwoven into our approach to North Korea for a long time. And I think that was okay. It's debatable, but I think that was basically not very risky for us back before North Korea had nuclear weapons. But now that they have nuclear weapons, we have to, the furthest we should be seriously considering going in terms of a conflict is like a limited war. And that's like at the uppermost end. Like nobody wants to enter the second nuclear age with actual nuclear conflict.
Well, Dr. Van Jackson, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Van Jackson, Associate Professor at the Asia-Pacific Center for Security Studies. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining a new report from Public Citizen, The Company They Keep, A Guide to the Presidential Candidate's Domestic Policy Advisors.
But the atoms here, in spite of hysteria, it flourishes in Utah as well as Siberia. And whether you're a black, white, red, or brown, the question is this when you boil it down. To be or not to be, that's the question. The answer to it all ain't military datum, like who gets there firstest with the mostest atoms. No, the people of the world must decide their fate. They got to get together or disintegrate. I hold this truth to be self-evident, that all men may be cremated equal.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Taylor Lincoln, who's a research director of the Congress Watch Division at Public Citizen, who has authored and co-authored numerous reports on subjects concerning regulations, healthcare, worker safety, and political spending. And his latest report at Public Citizen is The Company They Keep, A Guide to the Presidential Candidates' Domestic Policy Advisors. Welcome to Background Briefing, Taylor Lincoln.
Oh, nice to be with you again. Thank you.
And I guess we have to make a distinction between the advisors that you have put together in terms of who's advising Trump and who's advising Hillary. These are mostly policy advisors. I recall that FDR once said that there are two kinds of people in politics, those that help you get elected and those that help you govern. And I take it that most of these people that are on this list that you put together for Public Citizen, would they be in the latter category? These are the people...
Very much so, right. So yeah. There's more people than we could have profiled in a piece like this. But the philosophy we used definitely was to look towards the folks on the policy side of things and not on the politics or the spin or the handling, positioning, and so forth.
Well, it does seem that on the latter, which is the politics people, that Hillary Clinton doesn't have, there's some problems with that campaign. I mean, they should be 20 or 30 points ahead. It's just astounding that something dysfunctional about that campaign. And frankly, her 2008 campaign against Barack Obama had its deficiencies too. So it's pretty odd that Hillary Clinton could choose a bunch of pretty really sort of credible people as policy advisors, but then apparently not to have the best team in terms of political advisors, at least there doesn't seem to be an adult in the room. And of course, there's a world of difference between your policy advisors and the political advisors, the campaign advisors.
Right. Well, my observations on that point are probably just no more wise than anybody else's, but she's great at policy. And if you look at her policy advisors, it's hard not to be impressed with the range of voices that she's listening to and also just how extremely accomplished these people are. And I don't think anybody doubts her command of the issues. And on their point, it may not even be a matter of who is her handler or spinmeister or whatever, but she has to go out in front of that camera. And it's just been hard for her to resonate, right? It just
they don't seem
to have the magic formula to basically make the country like her.
Right, right. It's very strange, isn't it? Somebody that's so qualified is running against somebody that's so unqualified, and yet there's this real possibility that this disaster could befall the United States, and we could have a total catastrophe for president.
Mm-hmm. It's a different kind of election year. I think that one of the things that my paper came to show, and I didn't set out to show this, I just set out to figure out who these people were and what they believed in, and then have been able to sort of absorb the results, having done the research and written these pieces out, is that as untraditional as this campaign looks, right? So people kind of say that Trump, he's an untraditional candidate, to say the least, for the Republicans. He's untraditional for a lot of reasons, but one of them is orthodoxy, right? He's broken with the party on trade. He's sort of broken with them on taxes. He's not a down-the-line traditional tax-cutting, supply-side candidate. And then in Clinton's case, well, she's at least poached a lot of support of traditional Republican support from people that just won't go for Trump. And this is mostly due to the foreign policy point of view. But I think when you look at who these advisors are, it's interesting to me how the people that they've chosen to have around, you kind of assume that those people reflect the candidate's views, are really quite traditional and to be expected for the Democrat or the Republican nominee, any time in the past 3 decades.
And again, I'm speaking with Taylor Lincoln, who's a research director of the Congress Watch Division at Public Citizen, who has authored and co-authored numerous reports on subjects concerning regulations, healthcare, worker safety, and political spending. And his latest report at Public Citizen is The Company They Keep, A Guide to the Presidential Candidates' Domestic Policy Advisors. So let's start with Trump's advisors. I could quickly go through the list. Chris Christie, Sam Clovis, Dan DiMizzo, Ed Fellner, Newt Gingrich, Michael Glasner, Henry Kravitz, Lawrence Kudlow and Stephen Moore, Carl Icahn, Don McGahn, Stephen Miller and Jeff Sessions, Senator Jeff Sessions. Now, a lot of those people are Wall Street people. Henry Kravitz, the Kudlow and Moore are CNBC, right? They're pundits.
Right, right.
And who give you bad advice, frankly.
Right.
Carl Icahn. So here's this Wall Street, this money genius, the quintessential businessman. Why does he need a bunch of Wall Streeters helping him out?
Right.
I thought he knew.
Well, I think it's interesting who he turns to. So if you take them turning to Kravis and Icahn, these are sort of icons of the biggest of Wall Street money and leverage buyouts and all of that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And big personalities, especially in the case of Carl Icahn, with a huge ego and people who revel in taking on the establishment and so forth. So that's interesting. Kudlow is interesting because, as I was saying earlier, as much as people portray Trump as not being the traditional Republican candidate, Kudlow was raised in the cradle of supply-side economics, and he's a protege and a partner of the father of supply-side economics, Art Laffer. So it's just interesting that sort of after all of this protest that Trump wasn't a traditional candidate, well, this is somebody that comes to be one of his big advisors, along with Stephen Moore, who's sort of like peas in a pod with Art Laffer and Larry Kudlow. So I think that that's fascinating in itself.
Right, but Icahn and Kravitz are often referred to, though, as vulture capitalists, aren't they? I mean, Donald Trump argues that I built buildings. One of the things that's troubling about Wall Street is that so much of Wall Street's about extracting wealth, not creating wealth. How would you characterize Kravitz and Icahn?
Well, they're certainly not building buildings. I think that in the most critical light, they're accused of making themselves wealthy out of strip mining companies, right?
Right, exactly.
To buy companies and divide them into their parts, sell off the parts.
Right. Well, of course,
the payrolls and so forth.
And the last presidential candidate was in that bag as well, was he not?
Yeah, probably. I mean, the more respectable side of society compared to Kravis and especially Icahn in terms of how Wall Street would look at him, but yes.
But Mitt Romney, of course, came first out of the gate to try and stop Trump by calling him a total fraud, and it clearly hasn't worked. Taylor Lincoln, let's quickly go through the list of Clinton advisors.
Yeah.
Roger Altman, Alan Blinder, Heather Bushy, who I know she's really a good economist, Aaron Chatterjee, Mark Elias, Jacob Hacker, Moyo Harris, David Kamen, Alan Krueger, Anne O'Leary, John Podesta, Gene Sperling, and Jake Sullivan. Awful lot of economists there. Let's start
with... That may have to, in part, to do with the way I selected, but yes.
Right. But then, of course, the Roger Altman was Assistant Secretary of the Treasury, but he also was a partner at Lehman Brothers, right?
Right.
And we know that Lehman Brothers were the... I'm trying to think of the polite way of putting it.
Precipitated the financial...
But yeah, there you go. They precipitated the...
But that was long after left Lehman Brothers.
But
he was there before his time at the Clinton administration.
Right.
And went on and founded his own firm. But yes, he was the youngest partner ever at Lehman Brothers. And I think that one of the things that comes through with Clinton advisors is just superlatives in terms of their performance. These are people who they all seem to be the youngest ever to accomplish something, or have given the graduation speech in college, or been a Rhodes Scholar, been a Supreme Court clerk, those sorts of things. The youngest person to attain a certain position at the State Department. So these folks tend to be super achievers. They are interesting to me, I think, in that they, generally speaking, have kind of made a name for themselves by pursuing what I would consider to be traditional liberal objectives, helping the poor, giving people with less advantage a shot, improving the safety net, and so forth, but oftentimes doing so in innovative ways. So, for instance, one of the people profiled, Gene Sperling, who served for a long time in both the Clinton and Obama administrations, has proposed as a counterpoint to the flat tax, he has proposed flat deductions. And so right now, if a person of modest means takes a deduction on their mortgage or their retirement savings, the amount of savings that they'll realize from the deductions is less because we're paying lower tax rate, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas if a wealthy person takes a deduction, they get a greater benefit because the deduction is taking off of,
right,
it's saving them from paying a higher interest. He's proposed making the deduction flat, whereas on the right, you know, there's a lot of momentum to make the tax rate flat.
Sure.
So that's just like one example of twisting the orthodoxies, but I think that you will see in these Clinton domestic advisors and particularly economists a lot of innovative ideas to accomplish long-standing left-wing objectives.
Well, indeed, you know, the criticism of Donald Trump's almost entirely fraudulent childcare proposals, which is the darling of his daughter, who made the outrageous claim that nobody's ever done this before, when the Democrats for decades have been trying to get the childcare bills through and the Republicans have been blocking them. His whole childcare plan only benefits the ultra-rich,
right,
or disproportionately benefits them. So there's
disproportionate. Yeah.
But I'm struck by Maya Harris, who's senior policy advisor to Hillary Clinton. Her work has been focused on racial justice, and she's the younger sister of the California Attorney General Kamala Harris,
right,
who's currently running to represent California in the U.S. Senate. So amidst all of these economists, we've got a few law professors. She's one of them. So is David Kamen. And I don't know, do we need more lawyers in Washington? I don't mean to be facetious.
Don't you think that that's a fait accompli? That's going to happen?
Right. Right.
Harris, I think she's interesting. She's one of the youngest people ever to be a law school dean in the United States. She was less than 30. She was made the dean of a small law school. I also think it's interesting that she coordinated a huge report, a couple hundred pages with many, many contributors, but it was on police. It was largely about police violence and the notion of the stop and frisk programs.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, this was in 2001. This is 15 years ago. And in many of the themes in that report have been echoed in the past, you know, 6 to 18 months with all of these police abuse cases. And I just think it's interesting that, you know, she did that work 15 years ago.
So, of course, we know Podesta's in charge of the campaign. He's a veteran of the Clinton White House. A number of these people, of course, have served in the President Bill Clinton's White House. But Podesta was the co-chair of President-elect Obama's transition team. And he's fairly widely respected, isn't he? I haven't heard too many.
Right. Well, I think he is. He's a hardworking, very effective Washington person who's largely worked kind of in the background and in administrative capacities.
Mm-hmm.
I think what's most interesting about Podesta vis-a-vis this campaign, and it harkens to a different Trump advisor, is that Podesta founded the group, the Center for American Progress, in about 2003 to be a counterweight to the Heritage Foundation. And the reason for doing that was because the Heritage Foundation had been so incredibly effective for the right in general, but also in influence the administration of President Reagan. So now moving on to the current campaign, if you look through this list, many of the names on this list who are advising Clinton have come right through the Center for American Progress. And so in many ways, he has accomplished his goal of duplicating the influence of the Heritage Foundation, a left version of what the Heritage Foundation accomplishes on the right. And then another interesting twist to this is that Ed Fulner, who built the Heritage Foundation and made it so influential, especially with regard to President Reagan's administration, is now on the transition team for Donald Trump.
Well, in terms of who might be Hillary Clinton's national security advisor, the only person on this list that would seem to fit that possibility is Jake Sullivan, who's the national security advisor to Vice President Joe Biden. He's a lawyer, right? What's his national security background?
Right. So I should say that this list, I constrained this whole project to domestic policy advisors just to make it a manageable project. And Sullivan, in this current capacity, is an economic advisor to Senator Clinton, or Secretary Clinton, but previously he was a high-ranking official in the State Department who was involved in secret negotiations with Iran, and then he was involved in the formal public negotiations with Iran, and is somebody who has often been cited by those in the know as somebody who's on the move in foreign policy in Washington, whether to be national security advisor or even Secretary of State.
So what then, since you've compiled this list of the top advisors for Hillary Clinton and for Donald Trump, Clinton's team is heavy on economists, clearly, and Trump's team is heavy on Wall Streeters. So
yeah, yeah.
What's the takeaway here? Could you make the case that the Trump people are people who have actually worked on Wall Street and made money, as opposed to economists who talk about money but don't necessarily know how to make it?
Well, I could see somebody making that case, couldn't you?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's not a case that I would necessarily agree with, but that
right.
seems to be a case.
You know, I mean, to some extent, I should caution people against making conclusions in terms of trends from the names I've selected, because there are more. I try to choose the best ones. But your observation, it's not just my report that shows Trump not having that many economists around. When he announced his economic team back in, was it August, there was only one economist on the list. Mm-hmm. Most of them were contributors to him and Wall Street folks and so forth. So it's not just my reflection that indicates him not choosing economists. He has not chosen them, and I think it's probably fair to say that Secretary Clinton leans towards academics and high achievers in the sort of academic NGO world.
Well, you know, there's already talk that Chris Christie is on your list of Trump advisors, would be the next attorney general. There's even a piece, I noticed at the Huffington Post today, saying that Peter Thiel, the billionaire mm-hmm. from Silicon Valley, could end up on the Supreme Court. Which
is that right?
Oh, my God.
Is he a lawyer?
I don't know what he is, apart from being, you know, a billionaire who put a publication out of business, which
right, right.
for a journalist.
And he's gay, apparently.
Yeah.
Not that matter.
Well, that's not an issue. It's the idea that you can that rich people can kill journalistic enterprises off. You know, it's bad enough the state of newspapers and the media today. And I just noticed that now that The Guardian is cutting back on its staff as well. So there are enough troubles in the world of media than having some arrogant billionaire decide he didn't like something that was published and use his financial clout to close
right,
down a publication. It's really an unfortunate trend, shall we say. So just
well,
to close
based on what Trump has said about the press.
Oh, God, yeah.
Thiel might have just shot right up the list by putting that publication out of business.
Absolutely. And Trump would basically, you know, go after the First Amendment itself by the sound of it.
Right.
Just in closing, then, where do people get hold of this list so they can look into more detail than we've been able to provide them with?
So at www.citizen.org, that's citizen like the watch or like a public citizen, which is what we are, our group, or if you Google the Public Citizen Presidential Transition Project, we are monitoring all aspects of the planning for the transition, of which this is a preliminary piece. We think many of these people will be in the eventual winner's transition team in November and December and helping to make really big decisions.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Taylor Lincoln.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Taylor Lincoln, who is the Research Director of the Congress Watch Division at Public Citizen, who has authored and co-authored numerous reports on subjects concerning regulations, healthcare, worker safety, and political spending. And his latest report at Public Citizen is The Company They Keep, A Guide to the Presidential Candidate's Domestic Policy Advisors. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about how the media and the minds of Americans have been captured by money, celebrity, and advertising, and whether Trump's style and success as a huckster will win out over Hillary Clinton's teacher knows best persona. Thank you.
wanted to take the time to thank you for that gift tonight.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Walt Glaser, who's a retired American historian who has taught at the University of Pittsburgh and who has a letter in Wednesday's New York Times, Trump, Master of Marketing. Welcome to Background Briefing, Walt Glaser.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And your letter in Wednesday's New York Times really caught my attention. It's in response to an op-ed by Lee Siegel, The Selling of Donald Trump. And if you don't mind, I can read it because it's not very long. Lee Siegel is right that Mr. Trump is pushing himself as a product, not a politician. This is what he does masterfully. It works because we have more experience as consumers of products and advertising than as students of history and facts. The division between Mr. Trump's non-college-educated white men and Hillary Clinton's credentialed affluent women reflects this. Mr. Trump's style and success as a huckster and Mrs. Clinton's teacher-knows-best persona polarize this division. The real message and tragedy of the 2016 election is that the Trump phenomenon demonstrates the transformation of politics and democracy by money and advertising, which have not only captured the media, but also, sadly, an alarming portion of the American mind. So, Walt, let's start with the last line there. What portion of the American mind do you think has been captured? Will it be a majority now that the polls are getting very tight and there's a real possibility that the next president of the United States could be Donald J. Trump?
Well, I'd have absolutely no way of knowing how many Americans have been captured, and I don't trust the polls to be very accurate. The media focuses on polls and makes this into a horse race, but it's much more important than a horse race, and the polling methodology is increasingly problematic, and there also is a real question whether voters today really answer the questions like, do you support Donald Trump? Honestly, because they want to appear to be responsible adults, but what they really think and what they say are not necessarily the same thing.
But you're in the key swing state of Ohio, Walt Glaser, and the latest polls from Bloomberg give Donald Trump a 5% lead in Ohio. Hillary Clinton's campaign is sending Bernie Sanders there to try and get the young voters to, you know, to revive their spirits since many were disappointed in Bernie Sanders' loss. But on the other hand, I understand from internal polling on the Clinton campaign that there's a concern that Bernie Sanders voters are migrating to the third-party candidate, Gary Johnson, the Libertarian. And even if that is not the factor that has got them alarmed, the fact that these third-party candidates are polling in fairly, you know, 10% in Gary Johnson's case, less than 5 with Jill Stein. But if the race is really tight, then they could swing the election for Trump, particularly Stein's voters, who would most certainly vote for Hillary Clinton, as opposed to Gary Johnson's voters, who I think are evenly split between Republicans and Democrats.
Well, as somebody who's voted for third-party candidates in the past, I understand that, and it concerns me. I would like to go on record, at least, as of today, saying that Donald Trump is not winning, it's that Hillary Clinton is losing, and she has managed to shoot herself in the foot in almost every possible way. And I think that is tragic apart from her politics, because she's somebody who has invested so much of her time and energy and life in getting to this point. But I would also point out that there are a lot of people in Ohio who are suffering economically and who are getting disillusioned about the future for America and their own prospects and their children's prospects. I understand that from having taught a course for senior citizens several years ago, where it was really very surprising to me how many people said that they had enjoyed the benefits of the American dream, but they didn't expect that for their children. And if that's spread across the state and across the nation, we've got a big problem.
And again, I'm speaking with Walt Glazer, who's a retired American historian who taught at the University of Pittsburgh and who has a letter in Wednesday's New York Times, Trump, Master of Marketing. Well, it would seem also, given this recent bout of walking pneumonia that Hillary Clinton suffered from and got a lot of press attention, it's quite possible that she has an enormous burden on her shoulders, the expectations of so many Americans who are genuinely alarmed at the prospect of Donald Trump becoming president. Do you think that weighs on her?
Oh, I can't imagine the weight that she must be carrying in that regard, in regards to being the first woman to run for president, in terms of her husband's legacy and popularity. But that's a decision that she made and she chose, and she seems absolutely dedicated to overcome whatever obstacles there are. And while I don't like her personally, I certainly would vote for her over Donald Trump.
Well, I guess what she has in her arsenal, in given the limitations, and it is a bit of a puzzle to me to try and figure out why such an accomplished public servant with such a uniquely qualified resume for national politics, you know, most presidents don't have any, little to no experience, frankly, when they come in, and Barack Obama was an example of that. But, you know, it would seem to me that the people she surrounded herself with are where the problem is, and maybe the problem is that her choice of these people, because somebody's not serving her well. When you talk about all these gaffes, you know, the latest one of the of covering up her real illness, which was a stupid thing to do, seemed like a staff problem more than the candidate herself.
Well, I don't accept that, because if she's going to be president, the decisions are her responsibility, not her staff's. Mm-hmm. And I can't imagine that the email decision or the non-disclosure of her pneumonia were not decisions that she had her hand in. And I think she has a history of not being candid, not trusting the media, being very controlling, and constantly shooting herself in the foot by trying to control things that end up backfiring on her.
And that's what you refer to, I take it, as the teacher knows best persona.
Well, it is a large part of it. And having talked to a variety of people here in Ohio and down in Florida, we were in Clearwater Beach over the winter, and I like to walk on the beach. And when you're out walking on the beach in a bathing suit, you tend to run into a variety of people, and they don't know really who you are, and you don't know who they are. And I had some very candid conversations with people about politics. And the fact of the matter is that people may respect her experience, and they may respect her dedication, but they do not like her personality. And she obviously can't change that. And I've boiled that persona down to teacher knows best.
Well, she does have some pretty good surrogates, and it looks like she's going to need them. I mentioned that Bernie Sanders is going to be campaigning for her in Ohio. I think President Obama, I think his worst nightmare is the idea that his legacy would be destroyed by Donald Trump. I think he genuinely is terrified at that prospect of not just his own legacy being destroyed, but Donald Trump becoming the president of the United States, since Obama has been in there for two terms and knows what the job entails and how manifestly unqualified Trump is. But yet none of this seems to get across, does it? I mean, you know, we can't seem to be able to get to Trump's supporters and point out the obvious, that this guy's a fraud. But at the same time, even progressives don't seem to be alarmed by him. They were alarmed by Reagan. They were alarmed by George W. Bush. But this time around, the threat is 1,000 times worse than Bush or Reagan to progressive values. But I get a sense of complacency. I mean, I can't understand how anybody would.
Well, if I can interrupt you, I don't think it's complacency. I think that the media and the pundits, by and large, are missing a fundamental change in the American voter and the American mind. That I don't know whether you're familiar with the academic term negative reference politics.
Not really, but explain it.
Well, it's that people often vote against something more strongly or feel more strongly about something that they don't like than something they do like. And I think that in America today, there is a pervasive hostility, anger, frustration, whatever you want to call it, with Wall Street, certainly with Washington. And when you talk about Trump voters, I think a lot of them are angry at women, blacks, gays, because those are the people that Obama seems to be trying to help, not them. And those are the people who are getting ahead, not them. So you talk to somebody who's out of work in Hazard, Kentucky, and he thinks he's played the game by the rules and he's lost his job. And Hillary and Obama say that the coal industry is dead. It's not surprising that they're angry, and they may be irrational. And they sadly, they're not realizing that the government's probably their best hope. And Hillary probably would help them. But they have to have somebody to focus their anger at, and that's who is the target. And Hillary makes herself a very big target. Now, if Hillary could somehow channel herself through Bill Clinton, I think the results would be very different, because I know that those people liked him.
Well, you know, Bill Clinton is out there on the campaign trail. You know, he's not in the best of health, but he works enormous long hours, so he's doing everything he can. Obama's starting to come out, and he'll come out a lot more. Elizabeth Warren, I mentioned Bernie Sanders, Joe Biden. There's no shortage of surrogates, but at the end of the day, do you think surrogates are sufficient? Does she have?
I think surrogates is just the way the game is played. I think when people go into the voting booth, I think that they are either voting for the candidate or the party. And I think that you're going to find that the majority of American voters this fall are going to be saying, who's the least offensive candidate? And that may end up resulting in Gary Johnson and Jill, whatever her last name is, Stein, getting a lot more of the votes than we expect. And you know, it may create an absolutely chaotic situation where there isn't a decision in the Electoral College, and it'll be thrown into Congress, and God only knows what'll happen.
And that, of course, will be the lame duck Congress. So it's a frightening thought that antiquated system could come into play. But just in the last minute or so then of Walt Glazer, is there a way, do you think, for Hillary Clinton, instead, for the very people that you talked about, and I think you described them very well, that instead of calling them a basket of deplorables, would it be a good idea to reach out to the disaffected Bernie Sanders voters and the disaffected Donald Trump voters and start feeling their pain, start understanding where they're coming from rather than insulting them?
Well, I am not an expert by any means on politics or the political mind today, but my impression is that there's a hardcore Trump voters, 25 to 35%, and there's no hope that Hillary's going to get them, and that there are some independents or people who are on the fence that are going to determine the outcome of the election. And Hillary and all of her experts and advisors have to decide whether she's going to move to the left, which is what I hope, and do something to capture Bernie's army and young people and their enthusiasm, or whether she's going to stay on her steady course down the center and try to capture Republicans who can't stomach Trump. And I don't think she can move in both directions, so that's going to be the question in the next 2 months.
Well, that's one hell of a roll of the dice, isn't it?
Well, I hope it's not a roll of the dice. I hope they make a smart decision.
I agree. And I thank you for joining us, Walt Glazer.
Well, it's been my pleasure. Thanks very much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Walt Glazer, who is a retired American historian who taught at the University of Pittsburgh and who has a letter in Wednesday's New York Times, Trump, Master of Marketing. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.